We are in a new section, or we're continuing on in Genesis 28, and we're now in verse 10, and this is Jacob's dream, although Jude is of the opinion that this should be God's dream. You said, why do they say Jacob's ladder?
That's right. It's actually God's ladder.
When it's actually God's ladder, yes. So Jacob's dream, God's ladder.
The song says they're climbing Jacob's ladder.
I don't think I've heard that song.
You haven't heard the song?
No.
We are climbing Jacob's ladder.
Oh, yes. We grew up that song.
Yeah. I'm sorry. If you want to sing it now, I'm sure. Are you guys with me? Like, have you heard that song?
We are climbing Jacob's ladder.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Everybody 50 years old and older in this room.
Mark, you know.
We need your wisdom. So if this is a good song, then we need to.
Yeah.
Okay, yep. Sorry.
Rewrite the song or something?
Rewrite it?
No, does it need to be?
I don't know. I don't know what.
We've lost a few oldies over the years. That's okay. There's been new songs.
So, Jacob is now on the run. He's been sent away by Isaac, and that was instigated by Rebecca to preserve his life, because Esau is plotting to murder him because he has stolen the blessing. Now we're going to see Jacob leaving. I think that's really anything that we're going to talk about is going to be more in the passage. I guess, so there is one thing here. I was able to do something really cool this week with Genesis, and it's an idea that was that I read in a book called In All the Scriptures. It's by Nicholas Petrosky. There's really only one chapter in there that's worth reading, but it's the chapter that this came from, and it's called Reading In and Out, or Out to In, Into Out, Out to In, something like that. But it's basically reading context, reading your passage, reading the passage that you're studying in its context, and having basically these circles of context go out. So you start in your passage, read the passage, whatever observations you're making. You kind of want to keep things going as far as your reading goes, but read your passage, and then you get through it, and then you read one chapter before and then one chapter after. And then has anybody heard this way before? Read one chapter. Nancy, you have?
Well, it wasn't called that. I've done that with Psalms. You know, okay. We're studying the Psalm. I read the one before and the one after.
Yeah, yeah.
So you just get a...
Yeah, yeah. So you... and then once you... So you've now read your passage twice, and then you've also read the chapters before and after. And then you read two chapters before, and then two chapters after. So now you've read your passage three times, and you just kind of keep going. And this guy says, keep going until you've read the whole book. Now, Genesis is quite large. There are some books where, if that's what you do for your study, you have done a great study, I found. But you also have spent hours doing that, which totally worth it. But I did that with this, and I spent about 3 hours or so on Tuesday afternoon reading this passage in its context, and I stretched all the way back to Abraham's death in chapter 25, and this is why I say you kind of have to keep going. You can't spend time writing notes down. You just kind of have to jot some things or whatever, because if you stop, like, you lose the momentum, the contextual momentum, and lose train of thought and things like that. And so was able to get back that far and then get all the way to Jacob's return and meeting back up with Esau there in chapter 35 or 36. And it was tremendous that one of these scripture journals, just being able to write notes throughout set. You can't see those. If you want to see it, there's writing in different colors all over the place. It was just, so I totally commend that to you. If you have a few hours to spend reading the Bible, I commend doing it that way. So, because you, yeah, I ended up reading this passage like a dozen times because you're just building it out. So, so hopefully that translates into the next day. I kind of piece things together, all my notes, and tried to make them a little bit orderly. So, hopefully, you'll see the value of that tonight. It, not really anything changed in the in the product, but it, as far as understanding goes, but it's definitely more informed by the context. So, okay, so I'll read the passage and then we'll make some observations and ask some questions and then go through it. Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran, and he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his bed and lay down in that place to sleep. He dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you all your offspring shall, and in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised to you, or promised you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called the name of the place Bethel. And the name of the city was Luz at the first. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone, which I have set up for a pillar, shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. All right, so observations and questions.
It's interesting that he puts God in the conditional statement there.
Okay, if you do this?
If God does this, then I'll do this.
Okay, all right. Good, yeah, we will talk about that. Good. That's not necessarily the way that you or I would do it, right?
Phrase in verse 15, behold, I am with you, I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not forsake you until I have done what I have promised you.
Good. So what does that mean? Does that mean like,
once I'm done,
I'm out of here. Like, I know what you're going to say next, Jacob. I'm out. No, yeah, basically, God is going to outlast everything that happens to Jacob while he's gone. So he's not saying, so I'm with you to the end. And
I know what happens. So it's
not, right. Yeah. Yeah. It does kind of look weird. But then, you know, by the end of Genesis, like God's still with him and saying, actually go to Egypt. It's good. It's fine. This is actually my plan. So, yeah. But it does kind of read weird. It's like, man, God only cares about him when he's out of the land. But we'll come. There's a reason why it's kind of put that way, because he's the first of his kind, in a way, as far as the family goes.
This is one of the never-ending kingdom promises God gives. All
yeah, yeah, with the blessing, the dust of the earth, the land. And give to you and your offspring. So yeah, there's
like we've heard that before.
Yeah, it just reminds me of Genesis 3:15 when God tells Abraham he's gonna throw him off.
In Genesis 15?
12. 12:3, not
12:3, okay.
Not 3:12, 12:3. It's the same promise again to Elon.
Yeah, good.
Did God ever, in all your reading back and forth, did God ever rebuke Jacob for deceiving his father?
No.
I don't know. This, when God is so positive to him here and blessing him, and you know, there was, Jacob gets a lot of slamming
grace
for being the deceiver, and how do we know that Jacob didn't know that he was to receive the blessing and that he was just bringing about God's will by deceiving his father? Or
like he was intentionally trying to...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we never, if we don't see God ever rebuking him or...
Yeah. There's... God doesn't have to say... God or Moses, the narrator, doesn't have to say, this, by the way, this was wrong. Like, it can be understood. Going in and deceiving, like, they're not necessarily any kind of deceiving his father. I guess on the face of that, that would seem like that's not the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so Moses wouldn't have to say anything there.
But before, God had consequences for Moses when he was angry and didn't let him go into the promised land because he
did right wrong. Yeah.
And in this case, we don't see consequences.
Right.
Except maybe sending him off by himself. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there is a consequence built in there where he essentially loses everything that he gained through that deception, as far as the blessing, the birthright. Anything that he would have laid claim to, he doesn't have anymore, at least while he's outside of the land.
But he also was deceived.
Jacob, it comes back on him.
With Leah and Rachel.
Yeah.
So it does, there is some justice that happens too. Go ahead. Right, yeah. But there is a sense of God does use this. He uses Jacob's deception and turns it back on him, not only with Laban, but also with his own sons. Because Jacob gets deceived twice. And even in the similar way that he deceives his own father, right? So there's a... it does, if you live by the sword, you die by the sword type of thing. But God uses that in Jacob's life where you see, by the time he comes back into the land in chapter 32 and 33, there's still some silly things that he does, but he's changed. He is totally changed. And he recognizes when he talks to his wives and his children about coming back, he said, look at what God has done. And he recognizes God has protected me. So what I would say about that is that Jacob deserved to be rebuked there, and in God's wisdom, he didn't. Whereas he does with Moses. He uses Moses to teach Israel a lesson and to teach us a lesson. But then he also doesn't do it with Jacob here, also to show Jacob his own character and to teach us as well, that we often do not get what we deserve. In fact, we get the opposite. And I would say the reason why it's the second for Jacob is because of his essentially direct attachment to Abraham and Isaac. That as far as in the progress of everything that's going on before we even get to Israel, the most important thing to do, now I'm trying to put myself in God's place, which is never a good thing, but rebuking Jacob at this point would not be the lesson to convey to Israel while they're on their way to the promised land. Like, no, I intend to bless you no matter what. So those are just some some thoughts about why you wouldn't do it there. What else? Everybody understands the ladder thing, so we don't have to talk about that.
I don't know why they always sleep on rocks and stones. It sounds terribly uncomfortable. They do that.
Good.
All the time.
So there's, I'm curious about this. Does anybody have a any different translation than put it under his head? So this is in verse 11. Any different translation than that, or do you have a footnote, marginal note for that? No.
So, no. I do.
It's been a fairly large stone, like a pillar.
Well, it's mentioned twice, because it's mentioned again in 18.
Good.
Like, I thought that was a weird detail that it's in there. Like,
yeah.
At his head.
At his head. So, yeah. So, the Hebrew, it's actually a Hebrew phrase, and it's a phrase here. So, it's the literally, if we were just going to take literally, like, this word means this in Hebrew, and it means this in English. So, from... at his head. And it's all one word. It's just this is how Hebrew works. It just puts these prepositions, attaches them to words. And so there's a sense in other passages where this similar kind of phrasing happens, is that there's a sense of where it's around. And so he's not actually laying on it. It's around his head. So, I mean, it's stones around his head. It's not one stone that's around his head. But it would be one particular stone that's covering his head, covering his face, and it's protecting, which actually gets after what God says to Jacob about what he intends to do. It's a protection. And this is why he sets the stone up and anoints it. So so it can be taken this way. But either way, this stone represents something of the dream that he has in the message that's attached to the dream, and it has to do with protection. So, so that's kind of what's going on with that. So now there is something interesting here that you have to kind of branch out to other what's around it. But stones start to do like make a they start to make an appearance in here. So when you get down to chapter 29, there's a stone on the well's mouth that was large, and they would roll the stone, and so if you did like if you track the stats on the word usage, like in this section, stones gets used like a ton, whereas in the rest of the Genesis, it's not really used much at all. And so, you know, is what's in there for what's the payoff, interpretive payoff for that? Like, I don't know. One guy says it's like Jacob's going to have a really hard time. Like, maybe. I don't know. I guess we could say something like that. I don't know if I have something better to.
Well, when they crossed the River Jordan, they left stones in the river and piled them up, and they piled them up on the land also. Yeah. They were
witnesses.
Kind of stones of remembrance.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that would definitely make sense of what's going on in chapter 28. Mm-hmm. But in chapter 29, why emphasize the stone that's on the well several times? So
the children would ask him, why are you stoned?
Right. So
yeah. Yeah. Well, I was talking more about the well.
But, the story about what
happened. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. All right. What else?
Why are the angels moving all the time?
Good. Why are they moving all the time? Good. Well, so we'll talk about that now. Where am I looking here? So,
12.
Yeah. Angels of God ascending and descending on it. and then the Lord is standing above it. So there's a relationship between the angels going up and down. By the way, the ladder, it can also be like a stairway or something like that. Translated as a stairway. We shouldn't have the image. We should have the image in our heads that it's like, it's big, it's large, not just height wise touching the ground and reaching into heaven, but also just with, like, so you have angels. The angels are not going up and down. There's a group of angels that's going down, and there's a group of angels that are going up. So if we understand that, then we kind of think through, okay, what's the role of angels relative to land? Because this is definitely emphasizing a place. Because it says a certain place comes up a few times here too. And Jacob even references a place, this place. So, and then the promise has to do with the land, bringing you back to this land. And so we got to make a couple stops here. So in Job, the sons of God, the angels come before Yahweh and to give reports, right? And one of those angels is Satan, is the accuser. And God asks him, from where do you come, right? And what does he say? From roaming about on the earth, right? And so something having to do with the land, okay? So angels, even in Satan's case, in that particular instance, there's something to do with the earth, with the land. Think about Daniel, okay? In the book of Daniel, there are angels that represent nations, right? And doing war against each other and things like that. So those angels representing, there's the Prince of Persia or whatever. Is that how it's put, Prince of Persia? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Michael is the one who fights for Israel, right? And so you have angels representing nations. And then you think about Zechariah. At the beginning of Zechariah chapter 1, you have these angels, they're sitting on horses, and they're just sitting there. They're just standing there, right? They're not doing anything. And they make the report that all is quiet in the land. And obviously that has to do with Zechariah and the concern, God, when are you going to fulfill your promises? And so there's a connection between the angels doing stuff on the earth and having to do with specific nations and even representing those nations in some way, shape, or form. And then also connected to a particular spot of land. Okay, press pause on that. That actually makes me think about what Jesus is doing with the angels of the churches. So that's just an interesting thought. And now, going back to what we're talking about, the angels ascending and descending, if it's two groups of angels, then one is going up because those angels would represent Jacob's presence in the land, in the promised land. And where is he going? He's going outside of the land. These angels are, another group of angels are coming down who are actually representing, would have something to do with the land to which Jacob is going. And so Jacob sees this not because, well, you know, it's these angels are, how do I want to put this? Jacob is seeing this because it represents God's protection of him no matter where he is. And so if the angels who are tasked with having oversight of this land to where he's going, where he ends up going in Haran, then those angels are there specifically tasked to protect Jacob. Whereas the angels, and those are the angels that are coming down. The angels that are going up, those are the angels that are tasked with would be tasked with protecting Jacob while he's in the land, but he's leaving the land of Canaan, but he's leaving that land. So that's the best explanation of this that kind of takes in all the details. Why angels? Why a ladder? Why are there groups that are going up? It doesn't seem to be this random thing. And in the context of the land, and it's Jacob and what God says later. So taking in all those details, I think that's the best explanation that I've come across. Now, the one thing that I would ask if I were you, like, well, what about Jesus? When Jesus says in John chapter 1, verses 50 and 51, can somebody turn there and read that? John 1, 50 and 51.
Jesus answered and said to him, "Because I said to you that I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see the heavens open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man."
All right, so there's similarities there, but also differences, right? You don't have, instead of land, there's no mention of a ladder. That would be assumed here, I guess. You don't have a mention of the land, and the Son of Man replaces the land, right? So, so Jesus, I don't think he's saying I'm the fulfillment of Jacob's ladder. I think what he's saying is that the same message that's being demonstrated there, relative to, actually, it has more to do with the place, that what Jacob ends up calling this place, this is the house of God. This is God was here and I didn't know it. What he says later, that what John has done in chapter one is to say God is present among, he tabernacled among us, right? He's God in human flesh. This is who Jesus is. And so Jesus is this, he's drawing on this, okay, God was met Jacob at Bethel, the house of God. And Jesus in his own person is that, is the house of God, is, and you know, John 3, or John, the end of John 2, the temple to which he refers is his own body. And so I think that's just setting up for the links to the temple and the place where you meet God. The Father is not seeking worshipers to worship him at this mountain or in Jerusalem, but the Father is seeking worshipers to worship him in spirit and in truth, and that's centered on Jesus. And so he's setting himself up as the, establishing himself, drawing on all this Old Testament imagery to say, I'm where you meet God. So.
You want me to read MacArthur's note?
Yeah, as long as it agrees with me.
It does. It's a graphic portrayal of the Heavenly Lord's personal involvement in the affairs of the earth. And here especially, as they relate to covenant, divine covenant promises in Jacob's life. The dream was to encourage the lonely traveler. God's own appointed angelic messengers ensured the carrying out of his will and his plans. So kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
It's showing that God's personally involved in carrying out these covenants.
Yeah.
I'm with you. I'm kind of like what he said before. I'm with you, and this is what I'm going to do. It's just a portrayal or a pictorial dream of what God is doing. So that's a little more generic. But
I think I'd emphasize the protection element of it based on what God says. But
carrying out the covenants.
Good. So that's my attempt to interpret the latter in connection to what God says. And I think that's really where the place, anything that shows up in this passage is centered on what God says. Like the most important thing in the passage is, and basically like the bar against which you would understand the passage would be what God says. So I think that's how best to interpret everything else that comes into play in the passage.
What comes to my mind every time I think about a stairway, the ladder stairway, basically the stairway that leads up that the priest would have to ascend to offer the sacrifice.
Yeah. At the altar. All right.
Can I give a good plug? The comment I made about the reference to the promises of God dealing with the millennium.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading a book, and if you ever have a chance to read it, you ought to read it. It's called "He Will Reign Forever" by Michael Vlock.
Yeah,
an excellent book dealing with it. Traces everything in the scriptures from Genesis clear through Revelation, all the passages that point to God's plan for an earthly kingdom here on the earth.
Yep. I was driving down. He'll read by next week.
No, I've got it. I've read through parts of it. Yeah. Oh, no, I fully agree. It's an excellent book. Yeah. Yeah. How close are you to being done with it?
Yeah, well, I got about done.
That's fine. Yeah, if you can stave off the sleep that comes from reading it, then you can finish it. Yeah. All right.
So, is there any significance with this being a dream about? Seems like didn't he talk to God? Talk to Abraham and
in a vision. That included.
Was it, in vision? I mean,
it was so. It's called a vision, and it's called It's called a vision, but he does fall asleep during the vision, and so it's like he like dreams and vision.
Before he destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah.
No, no. In Genesis 15.
No, I know. I'm saying.
Oh.
I don't know what I'm saying.
Okay. Abraham has a similar experience in Genesis 15. That has similar the same promise that's said here. It's the stars of the sky instead of the dust of the earth.
No, I'm. Yeah.
The significance of the dream would be that Jacob has a dream that doesn't need interpretation because he gets the interpretation within the dream. He gets the interpretation of the latter, what he sees, by God who's standing over it. Yeah.
Well, so this morning when you're describing dreams that happened outside of the promised land or outside of Israel, they needed and this one is inside.
So, it's typically anybody who's connected to Abraham's line becomes the interpreter.
Oh.
But the dreams happen outside the land, the dreams happen with significant political figures, but they need an interpretation, and that interpretation comes from somebody from Israel.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And so here, what's there's something. Jacob doesn't need an interpreter, which means that which points to. I mean, you need to have all of these other dreams, kind of dream instances, come up. And compare and contrast. And this is in part, this right here is in part why I brought that up, but also because it came up in the study. The fact that Jacob doesn't need an interpreter, God tells him clearly, here's what this is about, here's what I promised to do for you, shows the uniqueness of Jacob, and really it points to the uniqueness of Israel and God's plan.
Same with Joseph in the New Testament.
Yes.
Right, and Mary.
Yeah, so yeah, yeah. Like, there's no, like, I don't know what to do with that. Yeah, it's absolutely. Even when he's outside of the land, when the angel appears to him in the dream the second time, that we don't have anything, but just says, hey, you're able to go back. It's just narrated. So, yeah, that God's people typically don't need any help interpreting dreams.
So you're taking that because there's not a need for interpretation, that in the dream, it's explained. That's how you got to the idea of the angels being
yes.
Protection of women. Okay.
Yes.
Sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So and that's what I tried to emphasize. What God says is the interpretation of the image.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and it's about protection. It also explains the stone. It basically explains everything. Yeah. Good, okay. I think I can get through this in 20 minutes. Yeah? We'll see. Let's go. So Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. So the homebody is leaving. Remember, he's the one who prefers living in tents, right? And now he's got... So, I mean, you kind of put yourself in Jacob's shoes, and he's like, he's totally out of his element. And he's all alone. So that comes up in chapter 25, verse 27. Jacob does reference this in this moment in chapter 46. Actually, no, this town, Beersheba, this is the place where he leaves to go to Egypt in chapter 40, in chapter 46, when God tells him, go to Egypt. And so Beersheba kind of is like the central place in Jacob's life as far as it's home base for him. So he's going to Haran, which is the same place that the Abraham's servant went in chapter 24. And so he came to a certain place. This a certain place like this makes it distinct, but not. Like, there's nothing the script about it. Jacob says, I didn't know, right? But this place holds significance. And he goes there to spend the night because the sun had set. So, like, there's nothing, because the sun had set, there's nothing about the place that would say, oh, this looks like a hospitable place. Like, why does he end up spending the night there? Because that's when night came, right? So there's no reason why he stopped there except for that. And part of the reason for this is, like, whenever people are on are traveling, they would typically seek hospitality in cities and or towns, villages. They try to stay the night with somebody, but Jacob's not doing that. It's basically because he ran out of time. And so he goes camping, basically. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. Again, place, like, it's just place. And he dreamed. And behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached the heavens. So earth, heaven, and behold, angels of God were ascending and descending on it. Again, so this would be talking about protection in the land, whatever land he's going to. And behold, the Lord stood above it. So it's not just the angels, they're doing the Lord's bidding. And so Yahweh is standing above the ladder, standing above the angels. And so he's the one who has authority and power over everything that's going to happen to Jacob. And he says, and this would be the key part of the entire passage, I am the Lord, I am Yahweh, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. So we have I'm going to change colors here so you can see this. So we have same God. The land on which you lie, I will give you and give to you and to your offspring. Same promises, right? He makes these promises to word for word to Abraham and to Isaac. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth. He makes a similar statement to Isaac about this. And you shall spread abroad. So there's multiplication here. So again, these are same promises. Spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. So it's just going out. And in you and in your offspring, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Genesis 12. So same God, same promises in verses 13 and 14. And then here's the new thing, specifically for Jacob. Behold, I am with you and will keep you. This is protection. And keep you wherever you go. So this would be, okay, the angels ascending and descending and attached to the land, and will bring you back to this land. So to this place, to this land. Why? For I will not leave you. I will not forsake you until I have done what I have promised you. So God is going to outlast all the trials. So that's what God tells him. And the new element here would be the same God, same promises, different circumstances. So let's press pause here for a second. What are the different circumstances in comparison to the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac making these same promises? What's different about Jacob in contrast to Abraham and Isaac?
Not promised his son yet.
Not promised his son yet, but think more in terms of place.
Doesn't give the outline of the total area that's going to be.
True, yeah, he gives that to Abraham. Yeah, yeah.
Well, Abraham's going to a place God's telling him to go to, and Jacob's running away.
Yes, he's going away. Yeah. And then in between you have Isaac, who Abraham says... What about?
Don't leave the land.
Don't leave the land. Don't leave the land. So will God's promises be able to withstand a place where will God be there? Will God be there for Jacob outside of the land? Because God's promises are tied up in Jacob, right? And so what God is saying here, yes, your circumstances are different, much different than your father and your grandfather, but I am the same God, and I'm issuing the same promises, and I am going to protect you. While you're out of the land, I am going to protect you, and I will bring you back. So this explains why do Laban's hair schemes not work the way that he intends them to on Jacob? Well, because God's protecting him. Why do Jacob's just silly things like breeding practices, why do those things work? Because God, right? I mean, and we'll get to that. And it's just like, this is so dumb.
Why would he work 14 years for a wife?
Well, you got two wives out of it.
Yeah,
but
you
got
the wrong one.
I know. I can see why he's bruised.
Are you reaching for your umbrella?
But hey, it's only 6 years that he works for an entire flock, so that does put some value on the wife, right? So Nancy doesn't agree. We'll just move on. Let's just move on. All right. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. Remember all the place, like the certain place, and he just laid down because it's a time. That's where that becomes significant here. There wasn't anything significant about this. So the Yahweh is in this place. So he is, and he was afraid, and he said how awesome this would be, like fearsome, fearful. Fearsome? Yeah, fearsome. How fearsome is this place? Why? This is none other than the house of God. And when you just read that in Hebrew, it's Beth El. El is God. Beth is house. Beth El. And that this is the gate of heaven. Another way to put this would be this is the entrance point of heaven. Now, he's highlighting the specific place. Bethel is not the only place that would be the... In the grand scheme of things, Bethel is not the unique access point to heaven. Why? Because wherever God appoints for the place that his name should dwell, in the tabernacle or at the temple, that's the place. And so Bethel, and Israel misunderstands this because they kind of turn this into an idolatrous place later on. They're rebuked for it in Hosea. Yeah, Hosea actually references this passage several times in his book, both good and bad. But Jacob just responds, he's awestruck here with what happens. And this would be a good response, right? The fear of the Lord, right? The fear of Isaac has become the fear of Jacob. So that's how he initially responds when he wakes up. This is a good response. This is a humble and obedient response, and he recognizes that I'm living before the face of God. And so early in the morning, and this is where we have a couple of connection points with just some things that happened to, like, Abraham. He sets out early in the morning to sacrifice Isaac. And just some connection points there. Jacob took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on it. So this is probably not one of those, like, Stonehenge stones. But it's probably fairly large that it would be. It would be described. It's like he's marking the place. So he sets up the pillar, and this is, I mean, he's dedicating the place. Dedication, sets up the pillar, and he pours oil on top of it. This would consecrate it. All right, so mark it out as being, so another way to put it, he anoints it. And they called the place of the name Bethel, but the city was Luz at first. And this is important because of what Jacob will say in chapter 48, verse 3, when he recounts his life to Joseph, when he's about to bless Joseph's sons. And he says, God met me at Luz. And so this moment, this dream, this is the transformation point for Jacob. And so he never forgets this, and he will actually come back to this place in chapter 30, or he'll talk about it in chapter 31, and also in chapter 35, he'll actually come back to this very place. And he will just, his amazement doesn't leave. Not only because he met God here, but also because what God said he was going to do, he did. And he went over and above, because this is where he says, when he comes back, he said, or no, when he talks to his family, he says, I left with a staff and that's it. And now look at me, I'm two companies. It was just, he's just amazed at what God has done. Not only has he protected him, preserved him, but he's increased him, which brings up the other part of what he says. Why does God talk about the multiplication? Well, Jacob's life is a foreshadowing, or it's a foretaste of what happens for Israel. Like, from one man, all these tribes come. And 12 sons, one daughter. I mean, it's amazing. And God goes above and beyond what he says that he will do. The other thing is, so remember, he goes out with a staff. Now we find out, okay, he does have oil. So does he have anything else based on those two passages that I've, this one and the one I referenced? Does he have anything else?
Doesn't have a rock anymore.
But he found the rock in the place. He doesn't have anything else. So what does he essentially, what does he give to God here? He gives him everything. He dedicates everything that he has to God that will mark this moment. I mean, that's significant. Like, so when I came to this passage, I was thinking of, you know, especially when it gets to the conditional statement, and we'll talk about that in a moment, or the condition that he puts on God. When I was like, I was expecting to, and this came about through this reading in and out, but then also just having this passage just locked in my head, and then going to the commentaries, I'm like, yeah, that's right. Jacob, he is transformed here, where he gives everything to God. This is not Jacob like he's trying to pull a fast one on God. He's responding to God as a believer. So the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac has become his God. It's no longer his family's God. It's no longer his parents' God. Their God is his God. It's become personal for him. He gives up everything. Not much, but he gives up everything. Right? So it's just, it's amazing. And makes me want to revise some of the things I've said in the past about Jacob. Like, and that'll continue to happen. I'll say bad things about Rachel. I'll say bad things about Leah and Joseph too. I'll say bad things about Joseph as well.
For all have sinned.
Yes. But that just means I need to be careful, because I'll end up needing to give credit where credit is due. And yeah, so just call me Peter. I'll put my foot in my mouth and realize it afterwards. But so Jacob's, it's just this, he recognizes it all depends on God. And so he dedicates the place, and then he makes a vow here in verse 20. Then Jacob made a vow. So it's a solemn vow. So before I read this, think about, so Jacob has just called this the place of God, the house of God. Which another way to think about that would be the tabernacle, would be the temple, all right? So think about where other places in the Bible, it doesn't have to be before this event in Genesis, But other places in the Bible where you have somebody who's in distress, right? Jacob is leaving Esau in distress, uncertain about a future, tormented for different reasons, unsure, all of that stuff. In distress, appears at the house of God, makes a vow, and making a vow saying, if you do this, I will do that. We have actually covered one of these. Yeah. Hannah, she puts it the same way. She, if you will give me a son, I will dedicate him. So, and this is where, when I started to think about other places, like, well, this is not Jacob being Jacob. Then you'll be my God. No, he's just given him everything and making a vow, if you intend to keep the vow, is not a bad thing. In and of itself. It's just that if you're going to do it, do it. You got to fulfill your vows. That's more of a point the Old Testament makes rather than the New Testament. Jesus says, hey, be careful.
This was in the Greek. The if could make sense.
It could.
Since you've done all this stuff for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You are.
Which kind of backs up what you're saying, I think. Or, but it's because that's what my footnote said. It could be translated. The if.
Oh, does it? Does it say that? Okay. Yeah.
So the New Testament.
Because it's a key. It's a key clause. Sure.
The if makes sense. Or yeah.
Is it as best to translate the if as since?
That's what I was thinking.
Okay. So, yeah, MacArthur likes to do that.
So Jacob might be saying
it's best to translate it this way. Like, I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah.
Since you've done all this.
But it kind of makes more sense, no pun intended, but it does make sense because if he's truly converted, if this is his conversion,
yeah.
The only
problem that I can see with that is that this is a true, so Hebrew does not have future tense verbs, but they're imperfect verbs, serve as future, and this is imperfect. This is the Lord shall be. So if it were since, then he would say the Lord is my God.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so that would be why, like,
yeah.
Now I could see surely maybe, well, I don't know. I think I prefer if here. But speaking of this vow, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, remember God says wherever you will go, and then Jacob just expands on that. What is Jacob asking for? Give me bread to eat, clothing to wear. What are these? This is just daily provisions. This is what I need to survive. He's not asking for anything more than just to survive, right? So that I will come again to my father's house in peace. So I'll go there. I won't die. I'll come back. I won't be on the run. Well, I mean, I guess he's going to come back on the run when he comes back, but only in part of the way. But he's coming back in peace. Then the Lord shall be my God. I think it is troublesome. Like, okay, it's a vow. It's still troublesome. I am the God of Abraham. I am the God of Isaac. And I think that's more for us. Like, let's not treat God this way. Like, if you do this, then I think Jacob is like in a unique place. Like, I mean, he's a patriarch. He can almost do anything that he wants. I'm not saying that that's the way that he lives. I'm just saying, like, God is going to bless him no matter what he does. Now, having said that, I'll back up. I probably made an overstatement there. I'll back up. This is where Jacob starts. Like, when you came to saving faith, what was your spiritual condition? I mean, you were regenerated. You were born again. But where was your maturity level? Not much, right? Spiritual infant. Jacob's essentially a spiritual infant here. He's just speaking the way that he knows, right? And so by the time we get to the other side of this, when he comes back to this spot, you'll see the change. We'll see the change. And so I think the application point that we should draw from this is, like, God starts with us where we are. He starts with us where we are.
Well, I wonder if he knew his parents' story. So, like, oh, I'm just going to go to my mom's brother. I'm going to water some camels. I'm going to come back with a wife. This is going to be easy. Like, because for Isaac didn't go, but the story that went, like, it all went so well. It's so easy. And it was this simple thing. So I wonder if he's like, okay, I'm just going to go. It's going to be peaceful. It's going to be easy. Like, knowing if he knew.
Perhaps, story. I mean, he has no idea that it's going to be two decades.
Right.
Yeah.
And I could see him thinking, like, I'm going to go. I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
I'm going to come home.
Yeah.
You know.
As long as he's putting, like, we think of him putting, saying that in just really reverential terms, like, I have just, like, met God.
The Lord's going to do the same for me as he did for my father. Like,
And isn't that an amazing thing?
Yes.
Yeah. Not like this expected thing or deserved thing, but amazing thing.
Yeah. I could just
I'm
gonna come back to my father's house in peace. Like, this is...
Right.
Where specifically is this in relation to the land?
It's
Bethel, but
so it's north of where Jerusalem is. So not on the way to Jericho, to the west, sorry, to the east. But more toward the north.
This is the house of God.
Well, because this is where God met him. This later on, he says, God met me here. And so it's the place of God, the house of God.
I just wonder how close it will be to the place where God's going to return.
Yeah, I think. Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah. That's, well, Armageddon's off to the northwest into the valley. So this would be more in that mountainous terrain, because he's making that shot toward Haran, which is on the other side of Sea of Galilee and all of that. So. Good. Yeah. So, and then he continues, and this stone, which I have set up for a pillar, shall be God's house. It's just representing the place where God met him. I think the tabernacle does end up being in or around Bethel for a time. I think I'm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can't remember when. It might be during the time of the judges.
It was there for several years.
Shall be God's house. So he acknowledges the role of the stone, and that he's consecrated it, and of all that you will give me, I will give a full tenth to you. So he's offering, this is, I mean, just imagine this, one-tenth, and Mark, you may have to help out, like, the significance of this, but one-tenth of all future income that he makes anywhere else, I guess, outside the land. That's a significant promise, right?
Yeah.
It's costly, I would think, right? So...
They didn't bring tithing up a lot. I mean, it makes me think of Abraham, you know, when Melchizedek shows up, and, you know, gives him a tenth.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's pretty the same. But is tithe brought up since then in Genesis? Is it showed up since then?
No, it only comes up with when Joseph's wheeling and dealing with the Egyptians. But I'm not even sure if that's a tenth or a tithe or how that's put. It is a certain percentage. But he's committing future income to God on the basis of God's pledge to protect him. So I think is the significance of the vow, especially in relationship to where Jacob is. Jacob does not. Besides saying, okay, for you to protect me means you got to take care of my basic needs, and that's where the bread and the clothing comes in. But Jacob does not add anything to what God promises. And he's believing what God promises. So this is like, I think this is, if we're looking for a turning point in Jacob's life, or maybe, you know, like his testimony of salvation, this would be the time. This would be the moment. It's an amazing passage where the faith of his fathers becomes his personal faith. I think something we can draw personally from this passage for us is that when we're in personal crisis, we can look at this passage and say, the God of Jacob is my God too. And I may not have these specific blessings tied to my life and everything rides on my life, but I do know that that God is my God and he is with me. He's with me. He will protect me. Nothing will come to pass in my life that he does not oversee. He's still standing at the top of that ladder. And so he'll protect me. So I think that this passage helps us make that application and helps us to encourage one another with that. God's going to protect us. He's with us. So any final thoughts or questions?
I think my question with the dream was coming out because of the maybe a misuse or abuse of the charismatic movement of dreams and mm-hmm. visions and using them. Like, seems like in here, it wasn't just a dream, as in, like, we think of, we have a dream.
Yeah.
I have very vivid dreams at times, and we wake mm-hmm. up and, was that real? Was that not mm-hmm. real? Like, I can't tell yeah. the difference until, you know, the day goes on to everything. Yeah. Like, this seems like, I know it's in scripture, so we take it as clearly this happened, and mm-hmm. it's true, but in the other sense, to not take that and maybe in application to ourselves, like Jacob didn't have any question. Like you said, he's changed by this dream. Like it was real.
Yeah.
It wasn't just like, was that a dream? Was that not a dream? It's very.
Yeah. I think as far as today, where this would come in is like, we have received the, God has now spoken to us in his son. And so everything's oriented around his son, and and he has given us his revelation about his son in the scriptures. Like, he ties everything to the Bible. And so so whatever weight would be put on a dream would be it would be light. Whatever dream is going on there would need to consider the circumstances and the fact that whoever has dreams in the Bible is like, they're significant people. And most every one of us are not significant people in the grand scheme of God's plan. So not saying that God doesn't or wouldn't give dreams. It's just that it's not going to be a normal thing. And if we come away, let's just grant that a dream happens. If you don't come away from that humbled, awestruck, reverent, zealous for the holiness of God, if you don't come away with that, with like my view of God has changed, then I would want somebody who has claimed to have a dream that's from God, I would want to see that in that person's life. Like, has this actually changed you? Because that's how Paul viewed his revelations, his visions, that they changed him. But they solidified for him, suffering is my role. Usually when we hear about dreams, it's kind of the opposite, at least in our culture. So I know dreams are a big deal in Muslim
Middle
culture.
East, I don't want to open a whole bill of can of worms, but like in the Middle East, I mean, there's reports where they'll say, mm-hmm. you know, they'll have this dream and then they'll meet a missionary and then they'll get saved or whatever. And so that dream supposedly connects them with a believer. I mean, the dream doesn't do that, you know, so.
Yeah.
But it's different,
probably.
And that culture is
right. Yeah, I mean, they put a lot of weight on dreams
and stuff in the Middle East.
They don't have the scriptures like we do.
Yeah, they don't have access.
Right. But it points readily to somebody who has the scriptures.
I think the end doesn't necessarily
justify the means or anything like that. But I think that we're in the position, like with what we teach, and I think where we're in the position is like, okay, I don't know, right? And we need to be comfortable being there.
Yeah.
But also push back on the like, no, this actually happened. Like,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, just look at how Paul responds to his dreams and visions and revelations. He doesn't put a whole lot of weight on them, especially the ones that he can't communicate to others. So I think 2 Corinthians 12 helps us think through those claims, at least in our context. And then, yeah, it just being in a different culture with all of that is, that's just another added kind of
twist.
Yeah.
You know, this Greek, though, is backed by the scripture.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's there. I mean, he wouldn't have any question that this dream was from God. It's exactly what God had said to Abraham.
Right.
I mean, I'm going to do this and this and this. So he's got a reference to God that it's from God.
Yeah.
Not just out of his own imagination.
Yeah. 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 Definitely the scripture is.
And I would confirms say it's not it, wrong it. Also, you might say, I don't know, but it's not wrong to say, I don't think so.
Yeah, no, it's not. Yeah, it's, because at that point, it's like, there's nothing for me to interpret. Like, I don't know. And I don't think so is okay, too, I think. Yeah, I don't think so.
I've that before.
Well, yeah. And, yeah. I guess one thing that we would, no matter where you are in the world, from our perspective as believers, ministry in the local church, we do not want to base our ministries, what we do, on dreams. We don't want to do that, right? So that would be the temptation over there, like, well, God's given all these dreams, and so as a missionary, it's like, I don't have to do anything, I just wait. And like, I don't think missionaries are doing that. I'm just saying that's like, well, I don't think, maybe not. I mean, maybe some, but the good ones are not going to be doing that. They're going to be, my job is to make disciples, preach the gospel. But I can imagine the temptation. I just have to sit back because then I don't have to get persecuted for stepping forward. I totally feel that. I totally feel that. So that would be a real temptation. Thanks for bringing dreams up. So I won't interpret your dream if you have a dream. So
mine are so silly that you would want to interpret them vivid dream.
Members of my family.
Really stupid.
Yeah. Members of my family share dreams with me, and I'm like, when is the dream over?
Yeah.
When did you wake up? That's what I want to know. Anyway. Okay. Yeah. Anything else? All right. Give credit where credit is due. God starts with all of us from some place, and God's with us. So let's pray. Father, thank you so much for the time that you've given to us, and thank you for the transformation that we're beginning to see in Jacob's life. Help us to be in awe of you. Remind us of who you are, and that we ought to give you everything, and put our futures respective futures in your hands too as well. We thank you that you are faithful to keep your promises. You are faithful to keep this promise to Jacob. And you will keep them to the uttermost, and we know that because of your Son. It's in His name that we pray. Amen.